You're listening to the Nightlife Podcast with Indira Naidu.
Few events focus the mind on the way we live like this pandemic is doing. When the basic human need to touch or to hug is virtually outlawed, we're forced to reassess what's important in our lives. Why are the lowest paid in our society, the teachers, the nurses, the carers, the cleaners, the Uber Eats cyclists, suddenly our lifelines, the ones we're relying on to get us through this? Why has it taken a crisis to expose the many structural inequalities in our aged care sector, for instance, in our casualised workforce, in our access to parks and green spaces? Well, many thinkers are using this time to reimagine a different future for us, a fairer one perhaps, one that has glimpses of utopia.
This mortal coil.
Well, on our This Mortal Coil discussion tonight is Deputy Lord Mayor of Sydney and author Jess Scully. In her new book, Glimpses of Utopia, Real Ideas for a Fairer World, Jess wants to see us transition to a caring economy, one, she argues, where humans will flourish. She explores various successful models of these glimpses around the world, from the democracy movement in Chile, where her mother is from, to our near neighbour, New Zealand, which is leading the way in bringing big tech to heel. And Jess joins me now. Welcome to Nightlife, Jess.
Hi, Indira.
Well, it's lovely to have you. The idea of utopia has been around since the term was first coined by Thomas More in 1516. What does the word mean to you, Jess?
To me, it's an aspiration more than anything else. I don't think it's something that we'll ever completely achieve. But what it is setting a goal for the kind of place that you can dream to live in. So I think there isn't one utopia. I think there are lots of different utopias, and we probably all have our own perspective on what our version of utopia is. But I think it's when we've been thinking about utopia in the past, we sort of think of that kind of, I woke up from a dream and I was in this strange place sort of model of utopia. Mm. And what I'm asking us to do is to look around and see those little slivers and glimpses, the little sort of green shoots of potential that could be utopian, that could contribute to the kind of world we actually want to live in.
Okay, Jess, so you divide your book into about nine sections where you argue for the urgent reform of most of our society, actually, from our political process to how we work to how we treat our carers. How has this pandemic for you tested these processes?
You know, I mean, it's really accelerated so much. I think we... many of us have this sort of growing unease that the system that we live in is unsustainable in so many senses of that word. You know, it's unsustainable in terms of the impact we're having on the planet, of course, first and foremost. We can, when you think about that summer we just went through and the way that our air was poisoned, the way that we couldn't go outside, the way we saw a billion animals, potentially lost and such huge swathes of the country burnt to a cinder. We see the unsustainability of it in our natural world, but also in our lives, I think. And I think for a lot of people, they're starting to think they're working harder and getting less in return, that they're seeing poorer outcomes for the next generation. And they think that isn't working for anyone. And what this pandemic has done is it's just pressed the fast forward button on that. And I think it's gone from being a sort of a slow build of a crisis to an urgent crisis where the inequality and the fractures in our system have been made more apparent and the need to deal with them much more urgent.
Mm. Now, in the past, Jess, when there have been calls such as yours for these sweeping structural reforms, the response is usually, look, it's too hard, it can't be done, we don't have the money. Why do you think the pandemic could provide a good opportunity for us to start making these changes?
Well, I think what it's done for me is really show that anything is possible. And for a lot of sort of political sacred cows have been shown to be kind of two-dimensional and easily toppled over. And there's this political concept called the Overton window. Basically, it describes what is considered politically acceptable or able to even be discussed in the mainstream conversation. And that window has blown wide open. And we're seeing ideas like universal basic income actually being implemented across a whole country, which is what's happening in Spain at the moment, where a million families are being given a no strings attached payment, not just during the pandemic, but from now on. And they're exploring how that will happen, how that might expand to the rest of the population. And I think we're starting to see sort of unexpected bedfellows sort of working together, like conservatives and the union movement, for example, to get us through it. So anything's possible. That's kind of my take on it. And I think we've got to take advantage of the moment.
And one of the things we have been seeing, particularly with the federal government, is quite different economic policies compared to what their traditional platform is to try to counter some of the adverse effects of COVID. Do you think that that's a temporary shift, or do you think that there could be something more permanent in some of those policies that we're now adhering to?
Well, you know, I think there is a tendency to snap back to business as usual. And we have this example from our very recent history to point to, which is what happened during the global financial crisis. So during the global financial crisis all over the world, Australia was less affected than other parts of the world. But in a lot of places, a lot of public money was spent to bail out the misdeeds of the financial sector. And then governments responded with austerity measures where they cut public spending in order to pay for those bailouts. And a lot of really good environmental traction, ideas like the Green New Deal really originated in the UK around 2007, and we're on the verge of being implemented there. We had a move towards a carbon emissions trading scheme here in Australia just prior to that moment, and we suddenly saw a snap back to business as usual economic policy, which tends to privilege people who are already doing pretty well. And so there is, I think, a risk that we could snap back to that, and we could see inequality heighten as a result. So what I want to do with this book is give people a range of alternatives that they can point to and say, well, why don't we try this? Because at the moment, and I think quite often when we talk about politics and social change, there's a lot of saying no, and there's not a lot of saying here's what we want instead. It's about providing some alternatives so that we have a point to debate from.
And one of the things that you say in your book, Jess, is that you think is wrong with politics is that our politicians don't resemble us. What do you mean by that?
Well, I don't know if you've looked at federal parliament recently, Indira, and you know what? They might be the most empathetic bunch of people, let's imagine that they are, in the world, right? But their life experience is quite vastly different, even, you know, when you look at the demographics, to the people that you live next door to, I'd bet, or the people that you see walking down the street. So there was this fabulous sort of assessment done a few years ago by BuzzFeed of the Australian Parliament, and they defined the typical Australian parliamentarian, and they said it was this guy called Andrew.
Eight
Andrews in federal parliament. And Andrew was 51. He had a law degree and another degree. He had two houses and two kids. And he was born here, and his parents were also born here. And he's from an Anglo-Celtic background. So actually, 50% of Australians were either born overseas or have at least one parent born overseas. The average Australian is a 38-year-old woman. The average Australian earns a lot less and owns a lot less than that. And Australia, the Australian population is something like 10 times as diverse as our federal parliament. So even if they were the most empathetic people in the world, it's hard for people who have a very similar band of training, a very similar cultural background, or maybe even a very similar similar income level to be able to understand what the whole of our society is going through or what we value. So we need all of our levels of politics to look more like the people that they represent. And I just think what a richer government we'd have if you had teachers and artists and you know, designers and people who care for kids or older people making decisions, coming from a place of knowledge about that stuff, and also coming from a range of perspectives from different cultures around the world.
I think most of us would agree that improving diversity in all workplaces is a good thing. But when it comes to politics particularly, it often looks so unpleasant from the outside, Jess.
It is, though, Indira.
And that's probably what puts people off trying to participate in it.
Yeah, you know, I have to say it is really it is really antagonistic, and I find it exhausting as well. And I think we've got to find ways to take the heat out of it, and there are ways that we can do that. But I think another thing that we can do is just bring more regular people, more citizens, into active citizenship and making decisions. And I think that means that you don't have to be a politician full time, but you can contribute to the political process. And for me, being an active citizen means not just voting every 4 years or every 3 years, but actually participating in a range of different ways. And so I interviewed people from Iceland and Taiwan, and so looked at some projects in Belgium and in Brazil and a few different parts of the world where citizens are involved in budgeting for part of, you know, their local government spending, and they sort of debate the best ideas. Or citizens are involved in a process called a citizens' jury, which we saw happen quite effectively in South Australia around the idea of whether the state should take on nuclear waste. And what that really does is it gets ordinary citizens, it empowers them with the knowledge and access to experts, and then it asks them to make a decision about what they think should be done. And it's happening at the moment as well in France, and there's 150 citizens who have been empowered to help design that country's carbon abatement policies and help make them fairer. So there are ways that you can be a participant in politics without having to join a party and move to Canberra and get involved in that and make it your whole life.
But I think that's going to sound more attractive to people, that's for sure. Jess, you also say in your book that the fundamental misconception of our society is that hard work generates high pay. Now, most of our listeners wouldn't disagree with you there. When we see the childcare workers at the moment, the nurses, they're making so much less money for so much harder work. So when do you think we stopped rewarding people for the hard work they do, and how do we change that?
Well, look, I think there's this sort of like original sin in our whole system, right, which is basically the old blokes who designed the system, Adam Smith and Karl Marx, both had really bad relationships with women, right, and they purposefully structured their philosophies to not count anything that happens inside the home as contributing to the economy in any way. And so education, care, a lot of those things that were done by women primarily were not considered productive. And so society became used to getting it for free and thinking that it was low skill. And a lot of the underpayment and the undervaluing stems from that. So I think part of it is recognizing that and figuring out how we address that imbalance. And I think we have to look at some better research, because there's some great research by the Women's Budget Group in the UK who found that, you know, if you spent the same amount of money on investing in care as you see spent on nation building construction projects, you'd get twice as many jobs, and you'd also cut the gender pay gap, and you'd create a huge benefit, a multiplier effect, in that you'd have more educated, healthier, better cared for people. You'd be able to you'd see more women in the workforce, because there'd be more access to care for children and older people, and so we've got to go back to the beginning with this thing and actually look at why we have these misconceptions and redress that balance. It's a really fundamental issue with our system at the moment.
And in terms of the work models that we're all currently involved in, you also champion cooperatives as a different work model. Tell us about the social care provider, the cooperative life, and why it's a better model.
You know, it's so funny. So many of the radical new ideas are actually very, very old ideas. And the co-op just kept coming back in so many different forms. You know, cooperatives when it comes to housing and land, cooperatives when it comes to creating businesses, or, you know, looking at new ways of getting workers to share in the benefit. And the Co-op Life is this wonderful company, organisation from Sydney that was started by a couple of care workers who thought, I'm shortchanging the clients because I'm being forced to race from client to client across town. And I'd rather just be able to spend the time with everyone. And so they started to organise themselves. And everyone who works there is also an owner in that enterprise. And last year, they then took over a regional provider in New England because that was on the verge of collapse. And overnight, those workers became co-owners and participants in that business. And they're able to cut overheads. They're not trying to have this profit-maximising approach. It's all about reinvesting in the people who work there. And I think models like that are part of what is called the democratic economy. And it's about saying to people, you who spend your working life in this enterprise are just as entitled, you're more entitled to the benefits of it than distant shareholders or people who might own this company on paper for a couple of minutes or a millisecond or whatever a trade of a listed entity might be. So it's about, in a sense, it's an old-fashioned idea, but it's also a hyper-local idea and one that's about people having the benefit for the responsibilities that they have as well.
You're listening to Nightlife with Indira Naidoo, and I'm with Deputy Lord Mayor of Sydney, Jess Scully, and we're talking about her new book, Glimpses of Utopia, Real Ideas for a Fairer World. Now, Jess, if I can take you back to your upbringing, can you tell us a little bit about it? Because your father is from India and your mother is Chilean and you grew up in the Sydney suburb of Liverpool. What was your childhood like?
I grew up all over Western Sydney. So I was in Liverpool, Fairfield, Campbelltown, Lithgow on the other side of the Blue Mountains, you know, and then more in the southwest around Bexley. And you know, my childhood was fantastic in that I feel like I got to see this more diverse part of Sydney, that where everybody comes from somewhere else and there are thousands of stories and different ways of doing things. And so I find that kind of endlessly inspiring. But I think something that I increasingly became aware of was that everything was just a little bit harder. Like it was just a little bit harder to get around. You know, things took a bit longer to get from place to place. There wasn't access to, you know, once I discovered what art galleries were, for example, I realized that there weren't that many of them near me, or that a lot of the decisions about big issues seemed to be made somewhere else and for someone else. And so while I had a, you know, very interesting and diverse and sort of colourful upbringing, and one that was really full of family and lots of different experiences, I did realise that my experience was quite far away from the world that I saw on TV, I guess like a lot of us felt, or the world that I saw decisions being made for. And I think when we moved to Chile for a little while, I kind of started to see the kind of end game of that kind of split in a society.
And so how did that form your ideas of fairness and justice?
Well, when we went to Chile when I was 10, I was sort of flabbergasted by how you could have such inequality in a place. And it was a much more extreme version of what I'm describing. You know, I had part of my family that worked really hard, worked in hospitals and in care, but found it very hard to get ahead. Everyone's in a great deal of personal debt, like it's a very high level of personal debt for people just trying to get by. And then I went to this English-speaking school where, you know, everyone had a maid and everyone lived in these incredible houses and you know, lived this sort of like, I guess, Hollywood sort of or Beverly Hills sort of lifestyle. And I could see that it made that place deeply dysfunctional, and it created an unease and a suspicion in that community where people on one side of the fence thought everyone on the other side was looking out to steal what they had. And
I actually just happened to be in Santiago a few months ago, and I was shocked by the extreme of that inequality. You know, there was part of the town that had lots of polo fields and clubs, and then a shanty town literally right next to it. Yeah, you know, that people had to walk through it or drive their BMW through it. I actually had not seen that sort of extreme, even in parts of Africa and Asia I'd been to.
Well, Chile is the 26th most unequal country in the world, and that's not like a cool list to be on, right? But the thing that I find so absurd is that Chile is touted as the success story of Latin America. And, you know, after the coup in 1973, a whole lot of American economists went in there and reshaped it to be the sort of their laboratory for what is called neoliberal economics. So this idea that the market will decide, that you just privatize everything, and that the customer, you're not a citizen, you're a customer, right? And so they've privatized everything from water to pensions. Their pensions system is privatized. Healthcare is incredibly privatized. Education, universities, you name it. And it shows you just how fragile a society can become when you have that sort of deep-seated inequality and where you don't have a social contract where citizens are entitled to anything. And because of that, since about October last year, there have been these huge riots and protests in Chile. Because and people say, you know, it's not for 30. It started because the price of a subway fare went up by 30 pesos. And they say it's not for 30 pesos. It's for 30 years of this experiment of neoliberal economics that has just torn this country apart. And, you know, things have been interrupted by the pandemic. But what they've actually come to in Chile is that there was this huge public movement where people said we need to rewrite our constitution to make sure that we have an actual social contract where we as citizens are entitled to this kind of social care, to a safety net, to being entitled to have some basis of equality. And, you know, I know it's extreme, but the Australia I grew up in prided itself on fairness, on not being a class, you know, on being a classless society, whether or not that was true. And I see us becoming more and more unequal. And when I see that us reflected in the mirror of what has happened to Chile, I really worry for us. And I think it's so urgent that we take steps to make sure that we don't go in that direction.
Yeah, you played and still play in the City of Sydney Council, Jess, a really interesting role implementing some policies, for instance, advocating for nightlife and creativity, affordable housing, getting ratepayers involved in budgeting. And it's interesting because I even found when I did some work with various councils around Australia to do with greening our environments and you know, growing vegetables in small spaces and things like that, about how remarkably reformist local government actually can be compared to other levels of government. Why do you think this is the case?
We're sneaking it in when they're not paying attention, basically. That's what's happening. I think people can take action in a really tangible way at a local level. And I think when so many of the big problems we're facing are quite abstract or intangible, when they come down to things like tax policy, for example, or land, you know, how we make rules about ownership and negative gearing and all of those sorts of things, which feel a bit more removed. that impact on sustainability and inequality and those sorts of things. When you can take action at a local level and see an impact in a shorter period of time, it's really heartening and energizing for people. And so I think people can have a meaningful impact when it comes to, you know, sustainability or local resilience or food networks at a local level in a way that wants them, you know, encourages them to keep going. And so I think that's why. But for me, local government is here and around the world has been such a major force for change. And there's this thing called the radical municipalist movement of local governments who are saying, we're not just about roads, rates and rubbish. We are about correcting inequality and addressing climate injustice, and we can do it at a local level. And I was so inspired by examples, not just here, but also in places like Preston in the UK and Rosario in Argentina, where local governments basically said, you know what, we're going to make sure that there's a credit union here that will actually lend to local businesses. We're going to make sure that everyone that we engage with and that we take on as suppliers pays their workers a living wage. And, you know, that they have, we as local government actually have a great deal of influence through the money we spend. And so I'm really interested in local procurement and community wealth building as two ways to make sure the money we spend stays and circulates in local communities, but also has a climate positive impact. But also in the work that we do around city planning and land use policy, which really dictates what can take place on a piece of land and who has access to it and whose needs are prioritised, because, you know, you can't usually have an urban garden in an expensive city unless you plan for it. You can't have community space or parks unless local government makes provision for it and plans for it. So it's actually, we're in a great position in local government, and I hope more people start getting involved in it.
Mm. And speaking of which, as I mentioned before, I mean, we know there's lots of rough and tumble in politics, even in local government, sometimes more so. So I guess I want to know from you, Jess, because a lot of the issues you tackle in the book are, you know, so fundamental, so across the board. Everything just needs a major overhaul from the way that you look at some of the processes. Can you give us a sense of how you continue to survive and look for alternatives, and what gives you hope?
You know, I think talking to people, the great gift of my job, you know, and being a local government councillor is I feel like I have this sort of small town experience in the middle of one of the biggest cities, you know, in the country. And because of that, I know that people care about other people and they care about future generations. And, you know, I don't have to look at what the polls say or, you know, whether some, you know, market research has said people feel X or Y way. I know from those conversations that people prioritise this stuff and they care about their neighbours. And the work, the research that we did just after the COVID pandemic at the City of Sydney, something like 85% of people in our community said that the number one thing we need to do is care for the most vulnerable people in our community. I mean, that's incredibly reassuring that we live in a place where people value each other and they want to support each other. I think the challenge has been that people haven't been given good enough choices to choose from. And so because of that, we fall back on the usual menu of choices. And because people haven't been invited in, usually in political and economic processes, to be active participants, that they can fall back on self-interest, or they can fall back on seeing through things through the lens of their own experience without having the benefit of understanding what their neighbours are going through. So I know people from my experience, you know, in this city and elsewhere in the world, that people are genuinely good and they genuinely care for each other. But I do think people have been deprived of the opportunity to be altruistic and generous in the choices that they make. And they've been deprived of the opportunity to choose from a fuller set of choices or to paint with the full palette. And what I want to do is have a better range of options for people to choose from so they can say, no, it doesn't just have to be public or private. It doesn't just have to be communism or capitalism. There's actually a whole range of shades in between. And I don't just have to be a consumer. I'm a citizen and I have a responsibility to give back to my community by being active in that and by taking part in decisions. And not only that, the whole system benefits from my input, which I think is not something that people feel at the moment.
Yeah. Well, Jess, you certainly walk the talk. So thank you very much for joining us on Nightlife tonight. I really enjoyed our discussion.
Such a pleasure. Thank you, Indira.
Deputy Lord Mayor of Sydney, Jess Scully, has been my guest tonight on Nightlife, talking about her book, Glimpses of Utopia, Real Ideas for a Fairer World.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.